This is Dr. Dave coming to you live from SoCal. This is part three of Officer Down, Shots Fired, circa 1975-ish to 1980, East Los Angeles area of California. Notorious for the Mongol gang, Hells Angels, in and out of that city. And both Mexican mafia infiltration. So a very active city. To refresh everybody, you should listen to part one and part two. Summing it up, the shooting's over. Officer Faith is in surgery. We're being debriefed after a very long night. The suspect is dead. Coroner's on the scene. The house fire is put out. And myself and 6 to 10 other officers are busy writing reports. And our lieutenant comes in and dresses us all down that we ourselves didn't take care of the shooter. And instead called the sheriff's office SWAT team. At this time in the department, I was already studying, but it wasn't for the sergeant's test that many officers thought I was. It was for going to medical school. So it was my very secret agenda, and quite impossible to catch up to the young kids in the dorms that I was competing for a spot in a medical school in the United States. So that ended up me realizing that I needed to leave the department in 1980. To pursue finishing my pre-med and getting into medical school. Both Officer Faith and myself were 29, 28 at the time of the shooting, and he was shot three times but survived. He was out of surgery. I stepped in the hospital after debriefing and barely keeping my eyes open. But he was either in surgery, coming out of surgery, or he wasn't to be disturbed by visitors. I saw him again that night, and it took 40 some years until I found out what happened in the interim. The last podcast I did on Gaza and Israel, I did just off the top of my head. And sometimes it's better because my flow of consciousness may not get all the exact dates, times, and organizations correct, but it's kind of free flowing. My notes in front of me are only one page long and just some key points. I was going to stop and then go back and come back and kind of split it up, but I'll get this wrapped up because you haven't heard the worst part. Worst part is that you get sworn in, you go to an academy, you take a bunch of abuse, you learn the first year on probation that you're nothing but a dog, and your training officers can treat you like a dog, ordering you to stay in the car or get out of the car or take the suitcase up, or it's a hazing to see if you can take it. So the first year of probation, you can be fired by looking at somebody wrong, and you know it. It's a difficult year for young police officers, and I was involved in his training, and I was not very nice to him. But he had other training officers, and he got past his probation and got enough years on that he was a good, solid officer. But he also had a secret that was similar to my secret, but I didn't know about it. Because at that time, I was not a Christian. I told you I was the Saul of Tarsus, persecuting him and mocking him. So what I found out 40 years later on a phone call to Officer Faith was that he had the golden opportunity to retire with 90 plus percent retirement. That would mean his salary plus cost of living plus medical dental insurance for the rest of his life and his family. And he could retire. But the only damage that he had, that since he was so honest, was he didn't say, "Well, I've got so much pain where the bullets went in." Miraculously, they didn't have any vital organs, and he came back to work in 3 weeks. Who does that? So think about what this is to the city. City is self-insured. You have a 29-year-old officer that if he were to go out on workers' comp at 90 plus percent for the rest of his life would cost the department millions and millions of dollars. So he was no longer an asset in the eyes of the department and the city manager. He was a liability, and they were after him. Some officers knew that. Some officers warned him just to take the money and get out. But he said the only way I could file a workers' comp honestly would say, this is anxiety. This is PTSD, which wasn't invented back then, wasn't acknowledged back then. And he didn't want to have any ties to a psychological mental health issue about flashbacks or the guns going off or loud noises and screw up his next career, which, unbeknownst to me, we later both found ourselves at a university in Los Angeles, which we both attended kind of on the QT, quiet. We both showed up in a pre-med lecture. I look at him, he looks at me, I look at him, he's looking at me. Now, you have to remember that once you come out of the closet as a pre-med student, you're declaring to the world that you think you're smart enough to be a doctor. And most people in that class will say, well, I'm biotech or I'm biomed or I'm biology. But why are they going to a pre-med lecture if they're going to be a biologist? They're not. They just haven't come out of the closet. So after the lecture about getting into medical school and grades you needed and the MCAT test and blah, 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 we talk and we both say the same thing. What are you doing here? And we both said the same thing. Oh, I'm biotech or oh, I'm biology. Unbeknownst to each one of us, we were both pre-med. So this is after the shooting. And we became bonded because we later confess, yeah, I'm pre-med and I'm pre-med. So we both left the department. So I am going ahead and I'll come back and close the loop. Lord willing. We studied together. He was over at my house all the time. I was tutoring him. He was tutoring me. Because we had a lot of really hard classes. We had inorganic chemistry for a year, organic chemistry for a year, algebra for a year, geometry for a year, calculus, physics, pchem, and the list went on. And if you got anything less than an A or a B, you weren't competitive. And there was only so many A's and B's going to be given out. So it was a fierce competition. I left the department with a letter wishing the department the most success, spelled wrong. Two C's, two S's. I put one C. To the chief that I was going on to greener pastures and to become a physician. That got a lot big laugh from my chief, who thought, this idiot can't even spell success. But not as funny as his lieutenant who came into the blackboard one time in briefing on an elevated platform in front of 12, 15 cops, sauntered up there with all the dignity of a lieutenant, flashing his bars and brass, looking like he's 15 months pregnant with a nice beer belly because they didn't have to go on the streets. Beautiful blackboard. I love blackboards. And he wrote a big N, Nancy, big N. And he says, put the chalk down, dusted off his hands, sauntered over to his desk, took a seat, elevated platform, looked down upon his four peons. He says, tonight we're going to talk about knowledge. So I never forgot that. And he departed his knowledge. Back to Officer Faith. He's back on the streets. The brother of the deceased suspect, who I told you was shot by SWAT and burned up in the house that was on fire, his brother sent notice to our department that he was going to kill one police officer from our department to revenge his brother's death. So just another thing to look out for when you pull a car over or you go on a call. And remember, most of these times, 90% of the time, we were in one-man cars, except for overlap. We'd have two-man cars. The idea is you have a bigger show of presence because a lot of black and whites are rolling down the street, but in essence, you only have one officer in each car. Back to Officer Faith. His target was on his head, on his back. The city wanted to find a way to get rid of him the cheapest way possible. 40 years later, in a telephone conversation I had with him, he said that either the night that he got shot or the following night, he was visited by the chief of the department, the city manager, and the city attorney. They were not there to check on his well-being, which I'm sure they inquired about. They had a check and a contract already pre-printed and with a pen, uncapped, ready for his signature. They were offering him, in today's money, $915,000 in today's money. It was $160,000 back then. But today it's about $1 million. So they were offering to pay him off, all things settled, no workers' comp. He resigns. They even typed his resignation letter for him. No workers' comp, no extra pay, nothing. And he turned it down. Came back to work, not knowing that they were watching him. The stain on that city to this day, you can't Google anything about the shooting. I've tried. You can find the other officers that were killed on duty, shot on duty, or took their life on duty, but you can't find this officer. It's hidden. After 10 hours of working, when your shift is about ready, you put what's called blinders on. You put your blinders on because the last thing you want after a 10-hour shift is to pull over a drunk or make an arrest or go to a call where you have to arrest somebody, then you have to print them, and then you have to inventory them, and you have to put them in jail, and then you have to write the report. So that's another 2 hours. So you put blinders on. You don't want to see anything. You don't want to stop anybody. You don't want to get into a confrontation, but you just want to go home. You're tired. Not 8 hour shift, 10 hour shift. So one night, Officer Faith was on duty. It was the time to put the blinders on, but he's got a car weaving down the road, crossing over the center line. We used to call them deuces because they were seeing double. He pulls them over. He does not call in the stop, which is officer policy, department policy. Got to call in the license plate, the vehicle description, where you are. And if you're code four, are you okay? You want another officer to start your way, or you want someone there now, or you need assistance immediately. So if you pull the car over, call out the license plate, location, north, south, eastbound lane, wherever you are, and you don't say anything, that means to expedite a car. So it's a negative response. You don't have to say anything. You just drop the mic and unit's responding. And you'll get a backup as fast as you can. Code four for now means I'm okay for now. Code four means I'm pretty solid. You can always ask later. Normally, we would check on each other if we're in the area, roll by, make sure everything's okay. And you do it for officers you like or you don't like. It's not a personal thing. So he didn't call it in because he didn't want it on the record. The guy was so drunk he could hardly stand up. And was what was customary at the time was we would lock up their car, make sure it was parked legally, lock up their car, take their keys and throw them down a storm drain or throw them in the bushes. So you made sure the drunk wasn't going to come back, find his keys, get back in the car and kill somebody. You send the drunk on his way. Or you give him a little ride outside the city. But on this event, Officer Faith had to move the car. He had to get in the car. He locked it up, threw the keys away, told the guy, Vamanos, get out of here. I know it's plural for we get out of here, but. And the guy usually leaves. Lucky. Thanking his lucky stars that he didn't get arrested, didn't get booked, didn't have to go to jail. Now, either this was the city's luck. I doubt if it was pre-planned. But they found out about it. For who, I don't know. So they played very coy. They found the car and contacted the subject. I told them there was an investigation. They needed access to the car. They towed the car into police compound. Detectives fingerprinted the car. They weren't looking for a bank robber. They weren't looking for a burglar suspect. They weren't looking for a criminal. They wanted evidence that Officer Faith had been inside that car. And they got it. They got his fingerprints on the steering wheel and the dash. Imagine going through this much work to hang an officer that's been shot three times for your department and came back to work. But their fear was he was going to get an attorney, it was going to cost the department and the city millions, and they had to find a way out, and they found it. They called him in. He said, "Did you make this stop? Did you stop any cars?" He started real general. Good detectives know how to ask questions they already know the answer to, make the suspect feel like he's comfortable. We're just chatting. There's no big deal here. Just a minor little issue. And then they get you in their snare. The old adage is, once you start lying, don't stop. So Officer Faith said, in his brain, if I tell them I stopped the car, they're going to say, well, you violated police department policy. And I'm going to be in trouble. And maybe that trouble is going to lead to me getting fired. So he said, no, I didn't stop the car. Oh, okay. And you never made contact with, and they slide a picture of the suspect in front of them. So now, Mike, the mic on the police radio squawks in his memory, and he looks at the picture, and Officer Face says, never seen him. But that was the guy he stopped. Without drawing it out further, first, I try to buy him off, freshly shot, with three of the top-ranking city officials trying to take a cheap route, not really caring about him. Second thing is they went out of their way to hang him. So they put him in a locked room. Now they got him. And they say, well, here's your charges so far. Violation of civil rights, lying to investigator, and violating department policy. We can either file a felony, plus you have civil rights issues to deal with. With the feds, or you can resign. No check this time. They had his resignation ready for him. He signed it. He cleaned out his locker. And he drove home. As I sit here now, 40 some years from the shooting, I think it's one of the most egregious things that a department could ever do. I just had a young patient come in who was an ex-police officer in the department. He told me a similar story. Now I'm in position to grant certain licenses and permits and federal things I can't go into. And he was an applicant, and he told me what happened. And then he told me why it happened. Different department, different era, 30 years after this happened, had nothing to do with it. But I was so sympathetic to this ex-officer who told me they put him undercover, that his suspect, and he was following, went into a store. He followed, not to be conspicuous. He grabbed something off the counter. He's in line to pay for it. The suspect bolted. He bolted, goes back to his car. Two unmarked cars come in and a van and pin the officer in, not the suspect. They take him in the van. They said, "You didn't pay for that. That's theft. Since you're packing a gun, maybe we'll get you for robbery." This is their own deputy, their own police officer that they put undercover. What was he doing? He was exposing dirty cops. And he got a little too close to the top. So he tells me this story not more than a couple months ago. And he knew that he had a target on his back. They took him into the van. They showed him video. They have been watching him watch them. Their internal affairs officers. So he was given a similar ultimatum. And what I can tell you, unfortunately, is small department, medium department, big department, they all do this. Officers are not afraid to do their job. Go into a walk up to a car with all the windows blacked out, you can't see in. They can see you. You can have three guns pointed at you. We're not afraid to go into that dark alley and chase that suspect with a gun. We're not afraid to roll balls to the wall, shots fired, or chase a suspect 80, 90, 100 miles an hour through a red light in a pursuit. We're not afraid of the bad guys. We're afraid of the good guys. It's the good guys that'll get you. So-called good guys. Our guys, our team. We used to call it the West Wing after the show, which came on afterwards. And that was all the brass. That's why we're graveyard. Didn't want a lot of brass around. I could study. I still did my calls. I still did my job. But I had to put up with all the nonsense that was going on. And like this young officer told me his story, he was pulled out of patrol, put on a special assignment. And then he got roped in. He got too close. He became a liability. And Officer Faith became a liability. The only golden lining to this story, or silver lining, is that Officer Faith and I both became physicians. We went to different medical schools. We both traveled to Guadalajara together. And if we didn't stick out enough, he loved Trapper John. He loved the image of being Trapper John in the MASH. And he would wear these most outlandish shirts. I said, "Why don't you wear something a little less, you know?" Oh no, he had to wear that. We had good times. We both got into US medical schools. We both graduated, both did residencies. And I can sadly tell you now that Officer Faith has gone to be with the Lord. I dedicate this last part to him. All he went through. God bless him. Rest in peace.